Welcome to another episode of JLL's Perspectives podcast. The race to drive down carbon emissions is on. A key part of reaching net zero targets is investing in renewable sources of energy, such as the sun and the wind. But it does take vast amounts of infrastructure to produce that energy and then to transmit it to where it needs to be. Typically, that infrastructure needs to be built on rural land holdings because of their location and the sheer size of them. But what options do landowners have when a renewables developer is honing in on their property? The answer to that can be quite complicated, but my three guests are experts in this area in Australia and in the United States. And in this episode, they discuss with me the type of infrastructure being built and by whom, the rights of landowners, and how they can have fruitful conversations with renewables developers.
I'm Will Gurry. I head up the agribusiness valuations team at JLL here in Australia. We work for both acquiring authorities and landholders on various projects from road, rail, power line, pipelines, and so forth.
I'm Larry Susskind. I'm a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. I'm also a vice chair of something called the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School that I helped to start 40 years ago that teaches about negotiation and dispute resolution. And third and finally, I'm the founder and I'm part of the Consensus Building Institute. We provide mediation services in some of the most raucous natural resource disputes around the world.
Jamal Waddington. I'm head of infrastructure advisory for JLL in Australia. And our team typically acquire land and interest in land for infrastructure projects. Those projects can vary between renewable energy projects, transmission lines, gas pipelines, road, rail, etc. We work almost exclusively for acquiring authorities, and we deliver projects all over the country.
I'm Rebecca Kent, host of this podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
We're going to talk about how an acceleration in renewables infrastructure is affecting landowners. And now I say an acceleration, I do understand there are probably or likely record amounts of money being put into renewables projects at the moment. I don't suppose either Jamal or Will you can quantify at all or give some sense of how big this landscape is in Australia. And then Larry, I'll ask the same of you in the US.
I don't know the amount of investment going to renewables in the, you know, the tens of billions of dollars, but it's substantial. Obviously, we're on a path to net zero by 2050 here in Australia. So I guess probably one interesting statistic and where we've seen a lot of issues in Australia is in order to deliver the net zero targets, the estimate is that we need to build 10,000 kilometres of new transmission lines in Australia to deliver that. And that's where a lot of the social issues arise. So 10,000 kilometres is a lot of new development and a lot of communities affected and a lot of properties impacted and a lot of stakeholders to be engaged with.
It's the quantum. It's also the acceleration of these projects that that's causing the issues. So, you know, in Australia, we have a lot of infrastructure, road, rail, pipelines, et cetera. A lot of those projects are quite predictable, whereas renewable projects, and particularly the transmission associated with those projects, in some ways has arisen overnight here in Australia. So it really accelerates the issue. The need to get the power lines in is sped up by the carbon targets, and it creates the frenzy and the reactions that we see in the market. One of the major issues we've got in Australia is, to some extent, we're reversing the old system, which was the source of power, the substation was usually located beside it. So whether it be hydro or coal or something like that, it's located beside the source and then fed into the network. We're now going out into the regions to where the source is, the sun, the wind, the hydro, whatever it is, and we've got this need to transmit back. So we're adding another leg to transmission. We need to transmit back to the substation to then feed it into community.
Larry, from one vast continent to another. I mean, can you perhaps help us put our finger on the size and scale of these projects at the moment?
We've had in the last 3 years at least a doubling in the number of efforts of people seeking permits to build renewable energy facilities. And this is across the whole country. It's not in one region. And it's there's going to be a very big focus in the next 3 to 5 years on offshore wind, especially on the East Coast. And we don't have anybody planning behind the scenes to determine what energy we need. We just have private initiatives to see if they can be first to build something and get a permit and go ahead. And it's 100% privately financed, but now with substantial tax breaks, it's changed the calculation.
And what does the transmission infrastructure look like? It's above ground power lines, is it?
Yeah, in the main, we've done some underground power lines, which obviously, once they're installed, don't have a long-lasting visual effect. They have quite a dramatic disturbance effect during construction. That's a big channel being done, a very big channel. But in the main, it's 220 kV and larger power lines. So in the context of Australia, that's typically a lattice tower with four legs and sort of 50-plus metres of height, you know, with six or eight wires strung from it. So, yeah, it's your big, ugly power line, not the little one.
So pretty unsightly.
Unsightly is the word. I don't think anyone would deny that. And visual blight, particularly in more closely settled areas, so smaller farms and rural lifestyle areas, is absolutely the number one concern. So we have a framework, we'll probably get into that later, but we have a framework of how we do our calculations and sort our compensation. But putting numbers on a visual impact on a property is quite an art. It takes a fair bit of experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jamal, you're doing a lot of the negotiating for land acquisition on behalf of, you know, government and developers. I mean, who are you talking to, perhaps put a face to some of the landowners for us?
Yeah, so I think, typically the landowners are, traditionally they're farmers, so they're graziers in some of the more remote areas. But I guess what we're seeing, though, is some of our projects are coming more into closer to town. We're dealing with developers, got rural lifestyle properties as well, so smaller properties. People from Melbourne, you know, during COVID wanted to get out of Melbourne and get a nice little piece of land an hour from Melbourne. So they might have a few acres there. They might have 10 or 20 hectares. So we're dealing with those people and proposing to put large, you know, 100-metre wide easements accommodating a 500 kV transmission line through a rural lifestyle block. So the impact of that is enormous. Irrigation properties, so, you know, and as I said, graziers. And a lot of these people have been there for 3, 4, 5 generations. So they are connected to the land. They have an emotional attachment to the land.
Can it be the case with some of these landowners that you could offer all the compensation in the world,
yep,
and they will still dig their heels in?
Yeah. You know, compensation is one thing, and we can compensate people for the interest in land that they're losing. That's fine, but you can't compensate for emotional attachment. Some people are that connected that they will never cash a check, and they're not interested in the money.
Yeah, right. And so, Larry, I know you and your team in the States have identified 53 utility-scale wind, solar and geothermal energy projects, just to quote one of your papers here, that were delayed or blocked between 2008 and 2021. Do you think there was sort of a lack of communication at play there, or do you think, you know, you talk about listening to Jamal talk about these, you know, second, third, fourth generation farmers, is it values? Is this some of the stuff you're experiencing?
We're looking at the projects from a different angle. The transmission lines are up. The issue is, where will the energy, the electricity, be produced? And wherever it is produced, it will get attached to the existing transmission lines. So it's not For us, when we say there's opposition, the opposition is to say buying or leasing, more likely, some thousands of acres of an existing farm, a part of an existing big farm in the Midwest, and putting up solar arrays that go as far as you can see. And there's a preference on the farmer's part for leasing this property because they'll get it back and the next generation will have a decision. The project will last 30, 40 years. And then it will they'll take everything down. It will not have adversely, certainly a solar facility should not have adversely affected anything. And they can, the next generation can do what they want. The battles locally are over the decision of a private investor to buy rights from large landowners, agriculturalists, and then build vast, 200, 300 megawatt solar facility has a lot of solar arrays, but they're not that high and they're off the ground. And sheep herders can make money by leasing sheep to maintain the grass and the growth underneath these. It's a very big deal for some of the agriculturalists to have a co-interest in what gets built in terms of the solar facilities. So the opposition to the solar facility, some of the farmers can make way more money leasing the land. And so they want to make a private deal with the developer to do that. Their neighbors who have no intention to do that or who aren't offered don't like the idea. They don't like the idea that their neighbor's going to make a lot of money leasing land or selling, and they're not being asked. And then there's others who just don't like the change from agriculture to another use. And they're also worried that everything else in the general area might become more industrialized if this happens and their agricultural lifestyle will be destroyed. There's people with environmental values who don't want either solar facilities or wind facilities because some of the habitats that will be affected and destroyed are endangered habitats. And why a developer who had 10,000 acres to choose from, chose 1,000 with a mapped habitat? I don't know.
But developers presumably have very good reason for citing particular areas.
Yes, they know that they can, with a relatively short line, connect to an existing transmission line.
Yeah, and to clarify, Jamal and Will, in Australia, we're talking about landowners being encouraged to sell or lease, and over what period of time, just so we can compare.
So it's a little bit of both, but I guess in the Australian context, I would say that wind is more prevalent here, and the preference for developers is really to lease land for wind turbines, and the compensation, if you like, for establishing wind turbines on a property is substantial now. The market is being ratcheted up, and unlike a transmission line where you have heads of compensation that are defined within the state-based legislation, really the negotiation of rent for a wind turbine is not legislated. So it's really a market approach, and you negotiate what you can from a landowner. So we've got examples here in Australia where landowners potentially will get in excess of $10 million a year in rent for the establishment of a substantial wind farm on their property. So that's good. That's good income to supplement sheep and cows.
Over how many years?
These leases can go 20, 30 years. Yep. So it's a substantial amount of money, and that is really another cause of some of the tensions as well, as you can imagine. Someone hosts a whole lot of wind turbines on their property at point A, and then the transmission line is required to come out of point A to get into the grid, and the neighbour who gets the transmission line, which is quite unsightly, as we said, and 80 metres high, get compensation which is governed by the legislation, the two don't meet. Certainly the compensation you're getting for the transmission online is a lot less.
Oh, that's interesting. So, Will, are those parameters difficult to work within?
Each state and territory has its own legislation associated with land acquisition. In the main, that legislation, while different, mirrors each other. So you have these concepts. You have the market value of the land acquired, whether that's a full interest for a road or rail, for example, or a partial interest. So a power line is a partial interest. It's an easement placed on the land and it's a shared use of that space underneath the power line. So that's the value of the land. We also have injurious affection, which is a technical term placed on basically injury to the remaining land. So that's where we talk about visual blight, moving of vehicles under power lines, you know, restriction of use. That all affects how you manage the rest of the land surrounding the power line. And it also affects its market appeal and what people would see or pay. And then we also have severance, which doesn't play as big a role in easements because you can usually cross them and get to the other side. But in road and rail, that's an issue when your property is divided in half. And then the other one is disturbance. So that, as I spoke about before, is disturbing the activities of the farm, you know, typically during construction, but sometimes ongoing. So that is, how am I going to sow my canola crop when you're driving your truck through it to go and pour the concrete to put up the towers? The conflicting interest that Jamal's talking about is in the projects we're dealing with at the moment, the guy at the very end has had the ability to come up with a commercial arrangement, and sometimes the landholder is in a very fortunate position. They might own the elevated piece of land that captures the wind, that is the A1 spot for the development of a wind farm. So they're holding the golden goose, and they are able to negotiate a commercial outcome. The guys that are affected by the transmission between that site and the substation or the connection are not able to command that level of negotiation. There isn't a commercial aspect to this. I must say, all the projects that we work on now have an element of commercial, what's called commercial uplift. So that's not something that we calculate. It's something that the project proponents calculate on top of what we decide is appropriate compensation. Those commercial uplifts are getting more and more generous as time goes on, and that is because people need to compete with this level of negotiation. We've also got what's come in recently and in some states is largely unknown, but and it's called different things, but for the purpose of today, I'll call it the community benefits payment. So that is an additional payment, again, that affected landholders are getting, and that is usually calculated on a per length of easement. So yeah, you get a certain sum per kilometre easement, no matter what the value of your land, no matter what the impact. And again, that's trying to offset that commercial arrangement. And to be honest, here in Australia, the competing nature of all this, or the comparative nature, is that transmission that is essentially a right to land, to use it for an easement, which is governed by legislation, is having to compete with the last person in the district who did a deal with a private mining company. You know, so we can't escape. You know, my neighbour got X for their property that's being used for this use. Sure, it's not the same use, but it's got to be somewhere around the same value of compensation.
Larry, I saw you nodding your head a fair bit. There are some parallels.
We have, in some parts of the United States, the issue that the sources of electricity are going to be in one place, pretty much outside the urban area, but the need for the electricity is more in the urban area. So we've got to move a lot of electricity around. This affects the attitude of the folks in the rural area. Why is this being built, especially if they're not the one selling a particular piece of property, but living near it? Why does this have to be built here near us? It's just going to serve those people in the city, and it's not going to help us in any way. We're opposed to it. But in the U.S., we've got California and New York that in the last 24 months, and it's about to happen in Michigan also, legislation that says for large projects, we no longer involve local governments in making these decisions. And that's because the nationally oriented political folks are concerned about the transition and how we meet climate goals in a relatively short time frame. And they no longer feel obliged to run the long processes of public participation and public engagement that have traditionally been one source of delay.
Jamal, there is a compulsory acquisition element, right? Can you maybe talk us through that and when that is enacted? And what
that's correct. So I guess the compulsory acquisition, the enabling legislation in each state for transmission, be it the Electricity Industry Act or whatever it may be, does give you access to the relevant land acquisition legislation. So ultimately, for a transmission line, you can compulsorily acquire, providing the governor and council, if you like, or the relevant minister approves that compulsory acquisition. But you don't automatically, for a transmission line, you don't automatically get that right. So you have to prove diligent endeavours to negotiate an agreement before a minister will grant you that right to compulsorily acquire. But those compulsory acquisition rights don't exist for a renewable energy developer, however. And I guess that comes a little bit to the amount of money paid because, as Will said, it's a commercial arrangement, and really you don't have that compulsory acquisition that you can potentially rely on if you can't get a deal done. So that's why the prices are ratcheted up for renewable energy projects. Authorities really don't want to use compulsory acquisition. They really want to negotiate voluntary agreements with landowners to get projects done.
You're all negotiators and mediators. What can be done maybe right from the outset, do you think, to get landowners and, you know, and developers on the same page?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rebecca. The key to all this is communication and I must say it is something that could be done better by a lot of the acquiring authorities, by a lot of the project proponents. Just the clarity of communication about the project, what impact it's going to have on your land, when that impact is going to be. And if you don't know the answers to those questions, you're better to say that you don't know. We haven't reached that stage of planning. We're not sure what the size of our tower is going to be. We're not sure how big our trench is going to be, but then come back to the person and explain that. There's some really predictable reactions from landholders. I mean, why should I have towers running through my paddock disrupting my business so that people in the city can have green energy because of the latest trend, carbon neutral, is a really predictable reaction, And we often get, can I put one of my cows in their backyard in the city and see how they deal with, cow poo every day and stuff like that? Like, it's a really, why do I have to deal with this so that someone else can have a benefit? Is a really predictive reaction. Again, we're getting the status thing. Why do I have to deal with this infrastructure in South Australia so New South Wales can have more power?
What do you say to that?
We don't have a great reaction to that. But I think, one thing that we can do better, and I think Jamal's team is doing tremendous work in this space in the fact that they go into a community and essentially live in that community and be part of that community for sort of 2-3 years leading up to a project actually hitting the ground. Once you've got good communication going between the landholder and the proponent that's impacting their property, you're able to get things done. Poor communication, poor messaging is where we get these breakdowns, and that's where we get legal action, political action, media outbreaks, and all that sort of stuff. So, I think communication's the key.
Larry, I'll come to you in just a sec, but I just want to, Jamal, go to you quickly about what we were saying there about you embedding yourselves in those communities. I mean, what does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, you have to, if we're working on these projects and we have any chance of developing any sort of credibility in the community, we have to understand the community, we have to understand the properties, we have to understand the landowners. And we have to appreciate the impact this is going to have on them, because in a lot of cases it's going to have a large impact, not only during construction, but once the thing's built and it's operational, it has a big impact on people. So the only way to understand that is to embed yourself and understand the issues and really get into it. So, you know, we'll typically say to our teams who are generally from a rural background as well, we would try to get people who understand farming, for example, and understand the community issues. You know, they should know every inch of the area they're working in. They should know where every gate is. They should know every landowner and how they operate their property, when they're there, when they're not there, when they're lambing, when they're not lambing, all of that sort of thing, so that we can really appreciate the impact this thing's going to have on them, and then put in place plans. Obviously, compensation's a big part of that, but also develop plans, property impact mitigation plans, for example, that really minimise the impact that construction will have on a landowner and their operations.
Thanks, Jamal. And Larry, what are some successful mediation strategies that you've put in place in the past in your long history in this space?
Well, I agree completely with Will and Jamal that empathy and local knowledge and communication are absolutely essential if you're going to try to come in from outside and work something out. The problem in the States now is there's, as Will said much earlier in our conversation, this pressure to go fast. There's really a different desire in terms of pace to get this done. And the problem then is that the people who are trying to go fast are not putting in the time to do the kinds of things that Jamal just described. They are hiring consultants who are doing an air photo interpretation. They're not even going to the place, let alone embedding themselves in the place. They don't empathize at all in the way that Jamal described for what's going to happen. And we now have this crash going between people who want to go faster than ever, and people who are saying, oh, no, I have some rights here and I'm being treated unfairly. And the reaction, if you think you're being treated unfairly, is to delay, to take advantage of every opportunity you can for another hearing. And what I'm going to suggest, as briefly as I can, is a way of proceeding that comes from other domains that we know something about, like international treaty negotiation. And developers are open to some suggestions along these lines that they were never open to before, because the resistance is now so great that they're almost willing to try anything. So when I say you're going to have to get in touch with people way sooner, and you're going to have to choose a representative set of stakeholders in this area, and you're going to have to, in those categories, let people name their own representatives, and you're going to have to set up an informal, not a government run, an informal dialogue. And I would argue, if you're going to have 30 people at a table every week for some period of time, and they're all angry about having their interests met, you need a mediator. You need somebody who knows how to facilitate that conversation. And then I say what sounds unbelievable to the developer, which is, and I think you have to commit to coming as close to consensus as you can before you even start the process, so that people know they have the equivalent of a veto. And if we get an agreement before anything happens, that proposal will go to various public bodies, and they'll know that the developer does this, then all the groups have come as close as possible to agreeing to what they're going to do. And my argument is, if these projects are beneficial, then the gains to the gainers should substantially outweigh whatever the real costs or losses are to the losers, and you should tax some of the gain and use it to compensate the losers in terms that they define. And I'm arguing that if we go slowly at the outset, we can go faster, because we can, within 3 months instead of 3 years, get a negotiated agreement. If everyone knows everyone's there working to get a consensus agreement, there's a neutral party managing it, and it's nobody's playing to the press, because there's no press. It's not open. It's not a political debate. It's a problem-solving session, and either you can work out an agreement or you can't. So that's mediated siting.
We've heard about engagement and communication being pretty crucial for developers. Will, what about for landowners themselves? Like, how can you suggest they approach these negotiations? What sort of mindset do you suggest they adopt in entering these negotiations with developers?
Yeah, when I'm talking to landholders, I'm always very quick to suggest that they engage their own representation. So that's legal and valuation. So, and that is not because I want to have a Barney with another valuer on the other side. It's because it just goes a long way to peace of mind. So, you know, as valuers in Australia, we are absolutely required to operate under the legislation. The legislation requires us to be neutral, in fact, err in favour of the landholder. So if we've got a choice in a calculation to round up and down or take one view or the other, the legislation requires that we take, you know, we favour the landholder in a compensation calculation. And to be honest, in Australia, landholders are typically quite slow to get their own representation legally and in valuation. And I find that interesting, because it's not a cost to them. The cost is covered under legislation. It's reimbursable to a reasonable amount. And I'm not at all saying that the landowner, you know, can't represent themselves or can't understand their own position. It's more that you're employing professionals that have these skills. They have the skills in negotiation, they have the skills in legislation, in understanding the legislation, and they have the experience. So if it's only so that you can sleep better at night, go and get your own representation is probably my first advice to landholders. My second advice to landholders is disengagement generally gets you nowhere. So you know, it's really common that we see people lock gates, always keep the communication going, even if your objection is, you know, as strong as it possibly could be. You know, you will never have this power line on. Even if you're that way minded, you'll never get this project up. You'll never have it on my land. That's fine. But you know, disconnecting from communication gets us nowhere on both sides.
Jamal, what are some of the questions that landowners should ask of an acquiring authority or a renewables developer? Is it, for example, what does remediation of my land look like after a lease? What if the energy developer's business fails? What happens to the infrastructure on my property? The long-term viability? What are some key things that landowners should discuss or get their legal representation to discuss?
Yeah, those things are obviously important, and I guess things have changed a little bit whereby In past times, I suppose those disturbance elements, we would say to landowners, look, let's agree some compensation up front. let's see what the disturbance elements are and let's quantify those afterwards. And let's tidy those up at the back end. Obviously, there's been a big shift now in mindset, and landowners want to agree all of those things up front. So let's try and quantify all those potential disturbance factors up front. Let's see what that looks like. Remediation. Let's develop a remediation plan now. Tell me how you're going to resow the pastures. What you're going to resow with, let's agree the mix. How are you going to affect the local roads? All of those types of things, landowners want to know as much as they can up front and get those things agreed. So how much are we going to get? Obviously, when are we going to get that money? What's the likelihood we're going to get that money? What can I do under the easement? What can't I do? Is that absolutely clear? Can I still farm under a power line? Can I not farm under a power line? How high does my equipment need to be? Can I do that without a permit, with a permit? We can try and embed a lot of those things into an easement agreement or a lease agreement or whatever it may be. We are getting more open to changing terms and conditions within agreements.
You know, I work on negotiations between countries about shared waters, like the Nile. And everybody put all the effort on writing the original agreement. Who's going to get how much of this water? And they fought and they fought and they fought, and then they got an agreement. There's not as much water in the river anymore, but there's nothing you can do. Everyone's taken their volume out because that's what it said in the agreement. Conditions change. It's possible to make contingent agreements. Let's negotiate it out what we think is most likely, and then let's have appendix A, B, and C and talk about if this happened. I don't think it's going to happen, but if it happened, what would the rules be? If this happened, what would the contingent payments be? I think it's a good idea to build into an agreement a lingering commitment where on a certain date the parties would meet, and if everything was fine, they'd have a beer and that'd be it. But if they needed an occasion to reflect on what's going, I think dispute resolution mechanism like that and contingent agreements solve a lot of problems that might come up later, because I think weird things are going to happen. You know, nobody ever imagined there'd be less water in the river for hundreds of thousands of years. There was always the same amount of rainfall. And climate change changed that. And all these 700 agreements about shared waters, they don't have any reconsideration except for 50 years later when we'll meet and talk about it.
Fascinating. Thank you. And I think that's a great note to end on, actually, some flexibility, contingencies, being open-minded, don't lock the gate, have a conversation, all those things. Thanks so much to the three of you for shedding light on this topic. Jamal, Will and Larry, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks.
Cheers. Bye.